Open loops. Open loops. Open loops. Open loops. Open loops. You must listen to the open loops, a theme park for absurd beliefs and systems of integration between the mind and the creative spirit. Open loops.
You ever notice how coaches start by working with anybody and then very quickly their niche becomes professionals and entrepreneurs? I guess they needed a couple of bucks. Your conscious mind can think on that because I'm speaking to you. Your unconscious mind is now tuned in to its favorite late-night talk show for the shamelessly fringe. It's Open Loops with Greg Bornstein. Conversations that bend. Bend and bend it will. Hey everybody, Greg Bornstein here. Consciousness disruptor. Cultural hypnotist. Without trance, sometimes, and of course, curator of experience. Put all those things together, you get a chief looper. We're looping on this show, because what exactly is an open loop? We'll get to that in a second. Yes, if you've never listened to this show before, but you've just read the titles, you'd think we're all over the place. And that's the point. Is it intellectually escapist? Or escapist intellectual? Or perhaps this hypnotic, magical, psychological, philosophical, metaphysical, supernatural, paranormal, conspiratorial, secretive, mysterious, and all-out whack range of topics is designed to challenge your existing belief systems by sharing radically unique ideas and stimulate your unconscious mind to step into the highest version of yourself. Perhaps, and perhaps not. Bending Perception. My returning guest, who was originally on this show, I believe it was episodes 80 through 82. We did a three-parter with this guy. Reality Without Trance, Deep Hypnosis Dialogues with Master Hypnotist James Tripp. Such a mind-blowing series. I need to go back to that because I learned so much about hypnosis and the psyche and the mind, and how to influence it, how to influence change, that I had never thought of before. It's hard to believe that interview series took place 2 years ago, and I always knew that I had to have James back on. Now, for those that aren't familiar with James Tripp, he is an amazing engineer of unconscious processes and personal growth and self-development and really all the stuff that I geek out on. I love, as many of you know, human potential in applied psychology, making things practical, and really just the, I suppose you could say esoteric, but it's not. It's not esoteric. It's the step-by-step flow of living that, I mean, people talk about how magic is often this willing of forces via your mind. It's manifestation too, right? You have something in your brain and you're able to bring it out into the real world. It's a theme we've covered a lot in this show. And when James started getting more into it, into the law of attraction, at least his perspective on it, and nonlinear creation dynamics, that's a word he started using a couple years back, I wasn't that interested. I wanted to get more into the trance work, the how do you make someone's hand stick to a wall and make them not see you, become invisible without using formal hypnosis inductions. James cracked that code, though, and he was ahead of the game, of course, and started focusing on really the games of life and creating in life and meeting your perception with your desire to make a difference in this world, make a difference in this world. Creation, living as a creative force. I had no idea what he was talking about. And then eventually it caught up with me. I realized, well, you know what? I love all this hypnosis stuff, and while I highly, highly recommend his online deep apprenticeship, I mean, if you want to understand hypnosis from a radically different perspective, you have to sign up. You should read his book, too. He had a book come out, Hypnosis Without Trance. Really good. I was starting to become more curious about his approach to task management, his approach to productivity, his approaches and his thoughts around motivation, and what does it mean to live a life where you're always, as much as possible, coming from a place of personal power, a life lived moment to moment in the now, but at its most creative, you being your most creative. That's what this episode's about. That's what this two-part series is about. And in part one, we cover some higher level stuff about learning and mastery and what it even takes to have a shift in your mind for the better, to get you into a place where you can become the creator of your own life. It's a great conversation. I'm so honored James came on and stayed on as long as he did. He has a new program where he's created a co-coaching community where you can build the life of you want, create results using these processes. It's called The Nexus. There's a link to that in the show notes. Definitely check that out if you like what you're hearing today. I'm telling you, this is one of my favorite interviews in the last, definitely in the last 6 months. And, you know, we interviewed someone that's in a romance with an extraterrestrial. I mean, you would think that would top the charts, but nope. This is about practicality. You're about to make a difference in your life simply by listening. I want to tell more jokes, but I can't. Let's get to the meat. It's delicious. Here he is, James Tripp. Today on Open Loops, we have the return of one of my favorite guests. I mean, we did a long interview the last time, really delving into the ins and outs of hypnosis, but I have since been following this man's work in the realm of personal mastery and creation. Some might say, for those of you that are familiar, this concept of manifestation, though I know he has specific thoughts on that. His name is James Tripp. He's an internationally recognized and respected personal success coach and teacher of personal mastery concepts and technology. It is my pleasure to bring him back. James, thanks for coming back.
Thank you, Greg. Thanks. Really looking forward to this. Really enjoyed the last conversation we had.
Yes, likewise, likewise. It's interesting the way that sometimes even my interests evolve within the realm of my technology. I mean, at first I had this relationship from the beginning, because what was tricky was I was studying hypnosis, but alongside that, there was a lot of people talking about accelerated learning. And they were connected, because once you get into NLP, you know, even these NLP trainers talk about how you can learn this stuff in a much more rapid way, and you can learn it unconsciously. So my brain immediately went, huh, okay, if I'm going to learn hypnosis, why not use the technology to learn it, so I'm not just having this linear step-by-step experience? And at the end of the day, despite months and months of studying accelerated learning and looking at the photo reading and all this stuff, I kind of came up to this realization that, well, you kind of just have to learn hypnosis. You know, there's only so much planning you can do. There's only so much, and that's something, that's a tension that I think you explore a lot in your most recent videos on James Tripp Chaos Wave on YouTube. This notion of action versus activity and tasks, and basically planning too much ahead. So I'm curious right off the bat. I mean, let me ask you this. Somebody's in the same position. They're going, mind technology is awesome. I want to learn this. I want to soak it up. I want it to go deep into my unconscious. But why would I suppose it's the question of opportunity cost. Why wouldn't I learn as much about how to learn quickly first?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think this is one of the downsides of NLP, which I love, by the way. I did a video on, I mentioned NLP, I think it was a modeling video, and somebody sort of made a comment around suggesting that NLP trainers, you know, are like drug dealers, and that they get people to pay up for big trainings that don't really deliver or are short-lived, and then you've got to get the next level and all of this kind of thing. And I thought, well, actually, you know, I don't agree with that at all. I got a tremendous amount of value from my investment in NLP. But the investment was not so much the financial investment. It was the investment of my time, my attention, and my intention, my intentionality around learning. Now, so I've got a lot of time for NLP. I think NLP, I mean, it did so much for me. I still make use of a lot of the stuff has become embodied for me. Absolutely fantastic. And I do think that it sometimes gets oversold in some ways. Now, one of the ways that it gets oversold, I remember years ago, first thing I learned, by the way, from NLP, one of my first interests, I spent 5 years self-teaching and exploring and really using stuff before I ever did a NLP practitioner training. So that was self-directed learning. Now, one of the first things I decided I was going to learn was the hypnotic language, the conversational hypnosis stuff. And I picked three different contexts in my life where I was going to be using this. One of them was teaching martial arts. One of them was magic and mentalism. And one of them was doing manual therapy, because I was a professional manual therapist at the time. So these three areas, these three domains where I wanted to use this conversational hypnosis stuff. And the Milton model, that was pretty easy to learn. There were products I could buy that would teach me that. There were online articles, even back then, you know, on the crude version of the internet that was, that I could do this. So I basically started to think, okay, so in these contexts, what are the sorts of things that I want to get happening for people? And it was crude at first. I thought, so for example, in martial arts, maybe somebody's a bit too tense in their shoulders and I want to get them to relax their shoulders a bit more. how might I go about doing that? I used to go, try to relax more, and that was no good.
Right.
So, you know, I'd say, so that's right. So just notice now how you can just release your shoulders. That's it. And just be a bit more present in this moment. And we're going to slow this down. So I started to get a lot more hypnotic in how I was teaching. And I got great results. Now, what this meant was that many years later, when I actually became an NLP trainer, I remember one guy, he sort of came on my trainings and stuff, and he wanted to hang around me a lot, came to my practice groups. And one time he said, you know, how come you're so good with hypnotic language? And I said, well, I work really hard to get good with hypnotic language. And he went, oh. And I thought, that's a strange response. And I said, you seem surprised by my answer. He said, well, yeah, because I was taught that it would all be unconsciously installed through my NLP training. And I was like, now, as a martial artist, and I knew something about what it took to get skills. You know, nobody goes to a weekend workshop on martial arts and comes out skilled. In the world of martial arts, you get skilled by immersing yourself in a skills development process. And some people get skills quickly and some people get skills slowly. And there's a difference between the two. You know, some people have good learning strategies and some people do not. Now, this was a surprise to him. And I understand why, because a lot of NLP trainers do sell that idea. We're going to use the technology to teach the technology. But here's the thing. Conversational hypnosis, if we pick that as an example, is excellent at evoking states and even, to use a sort of NLP type phrase, installing attitudes. It's really good for this. So states, attitudes, ways of seeing, ways of being, this sort of thing. You can do a lot with hypnotic language, with conversational hypnosis, to bring stuff out in people that way. You can do nothing, in my opinion, or very little in terms of installing skills and capabilities. So that's the distinction. It's a confusion. If you looked at it through Robert Dilts' model, which is sometimes called logical levels or neurological levels, and I always call illogical levels.
Right.
You know, if you look at that, and if people don't know it, you've got environment, behavior, capabilities, beliefs, identity, and then purpose. I think that's the whole stack. You need different stuff for working on different levels there. You see? Now,
right.
You know, this is important to recognize, because whilst I would use conversational hypnosis if I'm doing change work with somebody or coaching somebody or looking to get a mind shift happening, I don't expect them to develop skills that way. I can use that in supporting somebody while they develop skills. So, for example, when I was teaching martial arts, I would still use my conversational hypnosis to help people move faster and to remove barriers in learning. But I wouldn't, there's nothing I could do to unconsciously install the skills in them. There's a big difference there.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And what I'm curious about is, because I know that you did just do a video on modeling, and I know that I believe I've never actually taken a class, but I remember you did a review of Jonathan Altfeld's Genius Mapping course. And I think this relates to personal mastery and whatnot. What do you think when you are getting into that heavy level modeling of someone, what exactly, first of all, I guess my first question is, can you really model someone's genius? And if it's not, then the ability to, I guess, more easily facilitate, I guess it is, when it comes to skill development, I suppose my question is, how does that genius modeling relate?
Okay, well, with skills development, and again, there are lots of approaches to modeling, and you might use different approaches depending on what sort of thing you want to get. So when it comes to skills development, the best approach is usually something like an implicit modeling technique, like what John Grinder would call real NLP modeling. particularly if you're modeling physical skills and this sort of thing. It's a very useful approach. In this approach, you drop into a very open bandwidth state and you sort of switch on all your systems and you just kind of let yourself resonate with the person. And if, especially if it's a physical skill, you start allowing what is being absorbed through your senses to inform your own movements without getting your kind of left hemisphere in the way at all. So the sort of skills start to kind of emerge out of the body and you just allow the process to run itself and you don't do too much in terms of getting in the way of it. That's very different from something like Jonathan Altfield's genius mapping, which is a Q&A based system. You're questioning an expert because Jonathan Altfield was an expert systems modeler before he got into NLP. So he built expert computer systems that would do diagnostics and things like that. And he's bringing that expertise in and combining it with his NLP. But that's a more question and answer based thing. And that's more about how people might make decisions. Someone who has an expertise set might then make decisions about how they deploy those expertise, how and when.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Yeah, I let me ask for clarification about this then. There is a lot of talk, and again, this might just be marketing, but there is a lot of talk about finding your genius. And even I know I imagine your definition of personal mastery has nuances compared to even legends like L. Michael Hall, who talked about personal mastery for years. And I think one of John Grinder's books, Turtles All the Way Down, talks about genius and personal genius and stuff like that. I've always wondered, what are they talking about? What is this genius? I mean, genius is, we think of the Einsteins, we think of Da Vinci, we put all this out there, but I also know that there is a more personalized genius. There is this unconscious competence place where you find the thing that you're really good at and you live in that, and then eventually you start creating results and perhaps even a life based around that genius. I'm curious, what is your take on that word and how it relates to some of the fields that you're now exploring?
Okay, so are we talking about genius here or personal mastery?
Okay, how would you distinguish the two?
Okay, so I'm not sure because I've never answered this question before, so I have no idea what's going to come out of my mouth next.
Okay, sounds good.
But so personal mastery is a term that I like. And the idea of personal mastery to me is based around efficacy. It's the ability to make the differences that you want to make in the world. Okay, so this is how I think about personal mastery. I'm not saying this is what it is. It's how I think about it. So, you know, we are intentional creatures. We are goal. I think Jordan Peterson said we're aiming machines or something like that. I got this secondhand that this is, I didn't hear this from Peterson directly. But basically we go, I want this to happen. I want that to happen. I don't want that to happen. I do, you know, so we're looking to bring ourselves to bear upon the world to create the results that we want to create. Now, most people do this with very, very low levels of awareness for what they want, how they go about getting it. You know, most people are strangers to themselves. They don't know what's going on. You ask people, why did you do that? And they'll come up with some confabulation. They don't even know the real reason. This is most people. This is how we live. We live very unconsciously and very reactively.
Yes.
So for me, personal mastery is simply about how do I become more aware of myself, my drives, my drivers, my own psychology, what I might want, what I might be avoiding, why I might be avoiding that. You know, how do I become the master? How do I truly become the captain of my own ship? Now, this is not a simple thing, even on a philosophical level, because some people are terminally go, well, who is the you who is the captain of your own ship? And like, we get into a whole crazy realm of like, well, you know, which ego state is going to run the show and all of this sort of thing.
Right.
So it's a loose term. It's an imperfect term. And the rabbit hole just gets deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. However, let's take a really simple example. I'm not saying this is the totality of personal mastery, but it's one simple example. We do not live in the world as it is. We live in the world as our mind is making it up to be. Now, most people think that how I see it is how it is and what I see is all there is. So they're not a very good witness to their own sense-making processes, experience-making processes, and all of this sort of thing. So they are basically a victim to their own cognitive processes.
Yes.
Right? And I use that word evocatively, victim. Now, what does it take to stop being a victim to our own cognitive processes and start having some degree of mastery over our own cognitive processes? How much choice can we have within our own mind flow? How much choice can we have within our own attitude? How much choice can we have with regard to our own state? How much choice can we have with regard to our own, you know, engagement in a particular situation? Now, most people don't have much choice because they live in reaction constantly, right? They've put together a way of seeing the world and they react from that. And they're absolutely sure that their reactions are entirely rational according to how they see the world, you know. So for me, it's about getting into the driving seat of your own mind, of your own being. You know, who am I? What's the story of me? Am I showing up at my best in these moments? How effective am I at creating the kind of outcomes that I want? Where does my wanting come from? I'm quite interested in concepts like higher mind and lower mind, these sorts of things. So it's like a deep rabbit hole. But in the end, it's really simple. You could put it like this. Everybody wants success in life, right? Whether they want to be have success in business or even if they're a spiritual seeker, they still want success in spiritual seeking. So how can we become more effective at realizing things that we would count as absolute unqualified successes? That's what personal mastery is, I guess, to me. And then genius contrasts, I suppose, with that. Have you got any? I'm aware that what I said is like probably fire hosed a whole bunch of stuff. So, I don't know if you've got any sort of thoughts or questions there before I say anything about genius.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think this is a it is a very heavy concept, and I've heard you speak about things like this before, and it's why I wanted to have you on to talk specifically about it. Personal mastery, it does make me wonder this whole idea of people want success. It's interesting because I personally struggle with this notion of what other people's success is for me. I mean, I guess it's what everybody struggles with. So, but what people have defined as successful versus what I would have be success. And I sometimes wonder what is better ways to, at least at the very least, get clarity on what that is. I mean, do you have any sort of guidance to point people so that they can at least know, hey, I still want to do enough in my life to make enough of a difference to keep moving and not just sit still. But I also, it's like that old Tony Robbins thing, or a lot of coaches do this, where they say, how much money do you need to be successful? How much money would you want to make to be successful? And everybody overestimates 10 billion, 1 million, whatever. And then they go, okay, now let's actually break down the finances. And you find out that it's usually in the low couple $100,000, maybe more these days, but it's kind of one of those things where, I think people sometimes overestimate it. So I'm curious how you would help measure the internal barometer on what is my true success versus some cultural construct.
Right, right. Well, here's the first maneuver that I would suggest that people might benefit from. We get these ideas of success foisted on us, and they usually, you know, the cheap, superficial cultural idea of success. You say to somebody, success, what's the picture you get in your mind? Right? What's the picture you get, Greg? If I say success, what's the immediate picture that comes up in your mind?
Oh my gosh. I mean, I saw money and I saw a microphone and I saw an audience, you know? Yeah.
Right. So there's money, microphone, and audience. Somebody else might see a yacht and, you know, have bikini clad women draped off them or something like that. And somebody else is going to see, you know, diamonds and bling and you know, but oftentimes it's material success, right? That's often what people think of. Now, I find that a really interesting thing, material success. And some people that come in from a spiritual angle are very much like, oh, no, you know, this is just some kind of warping of our society. And then you've got people like Wallace Wattles, who in his book, The Science of Getting Rich, he frames that this desire for material success is just simply an expression of life force, because life force is always about growth and more, right? And it just kind of comes out in our society in terms of wealth and these sorts of things. Right. Stephen Kotler, I've just been reading Stephen Kotler's book, The Art of the Impossible. And he talks in that about how at the most basic level, at the most basic biological level, we all want resources. Right. So before money existed, we'd be looking for anything that was a resource for us, like some food, some more food, you know, some wood to make a fire. These are all resources. That was the wealth of the hunter-gatherer. Right. So the hunter-gatherer still wants wealth. They want resources. We want wealth and resources. It's just we've got this thing called money, which is a kind of catch-all. Instead of having to be specific about the resources we want to acquire, we know that if we've got a lot of money, we can acquire whatever resources we want whenever we want them. Right. And then on top of that, we tend to look at people that are good at getting resources and go, yeah, they're high-value people. So there's an ego element that comes in. Well, I want to be a person that's good at getting resources. So that can come into the mix as well. However, we are richer than that. So not everything is about resources. You know, there's a lot of research into motivation that starts to look at things like fulfillment. What's fulfilling for people? What values do people hold? How do they want to be contributing? So I think success can happen at every level. So I take this really simple definition, because for a long time I was like, oh, I don't know if I want to be a success coach because like, well, you know, maybe success is ugly. Maybe it's non-spiritual. Maybe it's, you know, and who am I to be a success coach? Because I don't have millions of dollars and yachts and stuff like that. And then, you know, but I realized that in my life that I've done a lot to achieve things, and I've been successful in achieving the things that I've set out to achieve. And I've got better at achieving the things that I set out to achieve. And then it kind of hit me that everybody always wants to achieve something. And I don't care if somebody's there meditating. What are they meditating for? Because they want to achieve success on a spiritual level. They want to achieve enlightenment or something like that. That's the dimension of success that they've chosen. So if you start recognizing that success can come from a variety of perspectives, it could be very personalized to you. I think you can sort of start to be a bit more aware about what you're doing and why you're going for it. You know, what is fulfilling? I've got somebody I'm sort of mentoring at the moment who's been pretty successful as an entrepreneur in the last 5 years, who's, as I understand it, been involved in 3 startups and done a pretty good job with those. I think one of them went bad, but the other one of them's on course to go well, and the first one went well, as I understand it. And he contacted me and he said, look, I'm pretty successful by a lot of accounts. Before that, he'd had a successful career, done all the right things, done well at university, got an MBA and everything. And he said, I just realized I don't want any of this. I want something. He said, I don't know what it is that I want. But it's something to do with what you do. It's something to do with the mind. It's something to do with understanding people, right? Now, this is not an uncommon thing. People often use this word vision. They talk about vision. Do you have a vision for something or whatever, or a goal? But a lot of the time, people just have a feeling. They go, that, there's something I want over there. There's something I want to know about. You know, for us human beings, curiosity can be a massive driver. Like, I'm really curious. I really want to know about this thing, and I want to know deeply. I want to understand this thing. That's often been a big driver for me, is deep understanding of things.
Yes.
You know, not necessarily a load of money, or not necessarily I want to understand that thing so I can make a load of money. It's just like, oh, wow, I'm really curious about this thing. How does that work? I want to know that. I want to be able to do that thing. Why? I don't know. It's an irrational passion. You know, so we don't just want resources. Sometimes we're driven by these irrational passions, you know, curiosities, all sorts of things. And I think that it isn't easy to know what we really want, because we do end up contaminated by culture and by schooling and by all sorts of ideas about what we should go for in the world. But I think that the more you spend time reflecting upon these things and asking yourself the question, and the more you do things like, I'm a big fan of working with our felt sense systems in our body. So this is basically recognizing that our interoceptive systems get used in cognition, but we're not mostly aware of it.
Hmm.
Now, once you are aware that your interoceptive systems are a key part of your sort of cognitive flow, you can consciously tune into them and start using them as sort of information sources and using them as ways into what people might call the unconscious mind and this kind of thing. So I use a lot of felt sense-based stuff. So I'm checking in with myself. Does that really seem true? You know, if I say I'm chasing this because I want this, does that really seem true? You can check in. Is this coming from some kind of cultural idea about what's successful? Am I chasing this because I have an insecurity that if I don't have this sort of thing, people are going to think less of me? You know, and this is, again, a part of personal mastery, is coming to know thyself. It's like, what are my drivers? Why might I be doing this? You know, and that's not a one and done thing. That's a lifetime of learning. We get a deeper ability to sort of see into ourselves and understand ourselves and our motivational sets. That's a part of personal mastery too.
Yeah, that's a really fascinating answer. And I'm more curious to explore this felt sense work now. I've heard you talk about it before, just because it is it is truly the basis of what I see the biggest problem is. I mean, another talking point, it's just kind of a self-development, I suppose. Well, in all of life, you hear, oh, yeah, but do you really want to be doing that? Look at these people on Wall Street. Are they really happy with their jobs? Mm. And, you know, I could see how so many people are numb for some reason. And one could get into some kind of conspiratorial thinking about this, or just the simple fact is because they want to choose the agenda that's going to make them the most money. That's just business and capitalism and whatnot. But yeah, so many people are numb to that notion of, well, maybe I could do something else and I'd be happier. People stay in jobs for decades and do things they're not happy about. And it makes me think that if people at a rudimentary level, not even having to go to necessarily, you know, the Landmark Forum or Tony Robbins or one of these weekend seminars, if we were somehow able to teach a regular discipline of how does this feel inside of me, that would then lead to people being much more in alignment with what they want to do. You know, I don't know if that's kind of your thoughts on that, but I know that there's a lot of talk these days about inner alignment. I've certainly been on a journey of living from a place of alignment. I know that can get spiritual, but do you have any sort of thinking on that, and what are the rudimentary steps people can take if they have those brief existential moments where they're going, yeah, I'm not sure this is what I want to be doing?
Yeah, I mean, I do think the felt sense is really important for me, because I want to look into myself. I want to understand myself better, not from an intellectual perspective, but from a real seeing perspective. Like, oh, shit, look, why am I doing that? That's why I'm doing that thing. Or that makes sense now. You know, suddenly seeing the plot twists in your own psyche. In a sense, what I mean by that is like a good plot twist in a movie. A bad plot twist is just random and arbitrary, but a good plot twist in a movie suddenly makes sense of the movie in a different way.
Yes,
right. You suddenly look back across the whole thing and you go, "Oh, that explains that, that, and that." And it all fits together in this kind of satisfying but surprising way. I love those in my own life. I love to suddenly get an insight, like a plot twist in my own psyche, where I go, oh, that suddenly makes sense of all this other stuff. And I'm kind of seeing more deeply. So I like to be able to do that. I like to be able to bring attention and consciousness into my own system with regularity to check in that I haven't just got stuck on a path, because that's easy for people to do. We're taught to do it. You know, we're taught from a young age, go to school, you know, decide what your career is going to be. And then you get in and we're, well, I've started on this now. And people can have success in something. And they can go, well, I'm good at this. I've achieved things. People respect me for this, all sorts of reasons. But they got into it for the wrong reason. It wasn't really about who they are or how they are. You know, and then if people realize that, they're often afraid to look at it because they think, oh, I can't start all over again because this thing I'm doing is working so well. So if I tried to start over again, that would be a bad thing. I just put it out of my mind. I'll put it out of consciousness. Now, one of the issues is the only way you can have this kind of self-knowledge, I think, is by feeling into the system. You can't do it through a kind of pure left brain analysis. Unfortunately, our sort of culture and our society encourages us to live either in the land of left brain analysis or raw, uncontrolled emotion. And felt sense is neither of those. You know, so it's not emotion. It's more like that hunch, that gut feeling, that like, there's something here, what is it? Sort of a thing, rather than just like, well, I feel offended, so therefore, you know, you have to change what you're saying or something like that. You know, it's more nuanced than raw emotion. But it's not like an intellectual dry analysis going, well, you know, what would be the correct thing to do here? Let me see. Let me write the pros and cons out of this particular decision. So, yeah, I think that if people were more adept at feeling into their system, that is, for me, the royal road to real self-knowledge.
Yeah. Wow. It seems rather simple in a way. It's just the actual step by step of getting to know yourself. Which I like that idea, that it's not always this grand revelation that smacks you in the face and you realize, because I don't think that's how most things work. I mean, I'm sure people have epiphanies. I'm sure people have these moments where, like you said, there is a plot twist and everything in your life has meaning, but I don't know how long those things, how long does the change last after that, the transformational breakthrough in the classroom?
I'm rather fond of sharing this quote, allegedly from Winston Churchill, which goes something like this. Churchill supposedly said, "It's amazing how often in life people stumble over the truth, pick themselves up, dust themselves down, and wander away as if nothing had ever happened." Right?
Wow.
Now, yes. This is a key principle. I teach this to people who I'm teaching change work skills to. So I say, watch out for the Churchill problem. So if you're doing change work with somebody, you don't want to get a massive shift in the session and then have them pick themselves up, dust themselves down, and wander away as if nothing had ever happened. That is the last thing you want to have happen. So we don't just want to get differences. We want to get differences that make differences. That's what we want to get, whether we're working with somebody else or whether we're working with ourselves. So for me, if I get like an epiphany or a shift or one of these plot twists in my own psyche or whatever you might call it, and I go, oh, wow, I want to check in with myself. Okay, so what is it that I'm seeing now that's different from before? And what difference does this make? I want to make sure I live into this difference. I want to live into this difference, right?
Yeah.
When I'm coaching, I haven't had this for years, but I used to get this quite a lot. It would really gall me. I'd be doing a piece with somebody and they go, all right, yeah, that certainly is food for thought. And I'd be like, no, it's not food for thought. Either it's a significant mind shift or it's not. And if it is a significant mind shift, live into it. What are you going to do to live into this now? Right?
Yes. Yes.
So this is really important to me. And it's, if I go, oh, that's nice. If that's food for thought, that's an interesting idea. Like, no, I haven't taken charge of making sure that's a difference that makes a difference. I've let myself shut my mind to it again. I've let myself unsee what I saw. So I want to make sure that never happens. So I'm pretty on it with that. You know, I've got this quote from a guy called Robert Ringer that I read in a book about 6 weeks ago. And I was just reading it this afternoon to my friend John. And before I read it to my friend John, I said, did I read this to you? I've read it to about 50 people already. Right. And I keep reading this quote to people and I keep reading it to myself as well, because it blew my mind and I love it. And I love what it evoked in me. And I love to reconnect with it over and over again. I'm going to read it to you right now.
Sure.
It's the leapfrog principle from Robert Ringer. It says, no one has an obligation, moral, legal, or otherwise, to work his way up through the ranks. Every human being possesses an inalienable right to make a unilateral decision to redirect his career and begin operating at a higher level at any time that he and he alone believes he is ready. Now, this was written in 1973, so he hasn't put his, her every single time. He's just put his. But that created a shift in being for me when I read that. Within the context of his book, maybe it doesn't sit outside of the context so much. But because that created a shift in being, I was like, oh, this is an interesting shift in being. If I were to carry the shift in being into the rest of my life, how would I be different in every situation? How would I show up differently in all of these places where I want to be making the differences I want to make? Right. And it you know, it gave me the chills in a good way, good chills. So I made a decision. Yeah, I'm bringing this in. I'm bringing this unilateral decision to start operating at a higher level into my own life. I'm going to love this. I'm going to enjoy this. I'm going to live this. I'm choosing to do this every day. Right now, I'm big on choice. This is a rare thing in the world of hypnosis and NLP. I'm big on the I that chooses. So much of the time, I'm big on commitment, on the idea of going, I'm doing this. I'm having this. I'm bringing this into my being. So if I get shifts happen that I go, I want to check in with that shift and go, how is this expanding me or is this contracting me, right? Is this bringing me closer to more of how I want to be and live in the world or further away? If it's bringing me closer to how I want to be, I'm like, I'm having this, I'm owning this. So I'll remind myself of it. I'll live into it on a regular basis until it becomes a part of who I am and how I am. I'm not merely relying on my unconscious mind to absorb it and change me.
Right.
And I'm taking charge of it. And this comes back to your original point that you were talking about, you know, unconscious installation and all of that. Maybe somebody will get a mind shift that is transformative. And they often can. I just got an email from a guy this afternoon. He said, I don't know if you remember me, but we had a conversation 12 years ago. And it was about smoking. And I haven't smoked a cigarette since. Can you help me lose weight? I'm like, right. Okay. I have no idea what the content of that conversation was, but we had a conversation and some mind shifts occurred that led to him not smoking ever since.
Wow.
You know, but now I wouldn't have at the time given him a practice to make sure he lived into the mind shifts we created, but he did. Other people wouldn't. He did. That much I know because he stopped smoking. So he didn't wander away as if nothing had ever happened.
Right.
Right. And you get this with clients. Some clients are highly coachable and some clients are incredibly difficult to coach. And the difference that makes the difference is the clients that are highly coachable are ones who have a natural, well, they have a tendency in place already to take the differences that emerge from the coaching session and to take them back into their lives and start living into them.
That's very interesting. Do you think you could go meta level with those? I mean, I know this is kind of going off on a different topic, but is part of the coaching work to get people to that place first before you then can actually get the change?
Right. When you know that this is a significant factor, then you can start being strategic about it, So a lot of people that coach don't necessarily know this. I was going to do a program a number of years ago called Coaching Coachability.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, which I ended up not doing, not because it wouldn't be a good program. It's just that, you know, there's 1,001 projects that I always want to do at any given time. So it would be a good project to do, but other things took precedence, so it's never got done. However, there is the best coaches know this. So there's my friend John, his coach, a guy called Steve Hardison. He always talks, he puts it in this term. He talks about creating the listening in the client. So there's a certain way of listening, a certain way that the client has to pay attention in order to be getting the kind of mind shifts. It's more than just that. But, you know, my friend John will often talk about it as creating your client. So if you take charge, you think, well, this client requires a certain kind of being in order to be taking this and making use of this stuff. If you take charge of creating and shaping that being, then you have more influence on that level as well. Right. So there are certain simple things I'll do. So take this out of the realm of the abstract. I might say to people, like I have a distinction, which is arguing about what is or isn't so versus exploring in the realm of meaning making. Now, often, if it's needed with a particular client, if I've got a client that lives from arguing about what is or isn't so, I'm going to have to coach them out of that really early on. Because if they're going to hang out in that, then nothing can ever change. And here's why. If you argue about what is or isn't so, you're going to argue from your existing belief set, yes. Which means you're either going to agree with what's said to you, which means that your current belief set can accommodate it entirely and easily and effortlessly, so no change is required. Or if it doesn't fit with your current belief set, you'll disagree with it, in which case nothing had to change either because it just got rejected. So people who pass information from their current belief set and go, do I agree with that? Do I disagree with that? Is that right? Is that wrong? Never get change. Right?
Yes.
It can't happen. Yeah. So what they have to do is they have to recognize that what we're talking about here is not right or wrong or truth. It's not about facts and fictions. It's about sense and sense making. And sense making is something that you can try on. You can try on a new way of seeing. You can try on some new sense. How would it be if this were the case? If this were true, how would it be? And then somebody goes into that new sense structure and they go, well, it would be like this. And now their whole system starts to come alive with the possibility. And they can play in this realm because it isn't about truth or not truth anymore. It's about playing in a realm of sense making. It's about playing in the realm of possibility, right? So you can get people who really play in the realm of possibility. They're going to be able to explore all sorts of differences. But somebody that's just checking in, well, do I agree with this or do I disagree with it? They don't get to explore anything.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. There. Yes, we've gone into the coaching realm a little bit, but I'm kind of in this non-linear. I'm going, do I follow the non-linearity of this? Because it's very interesting. Let me just ask you this, and I'm sure that I think it might be relevant to the sense of people listening to this that are like, I think in this way and I'm not open to your ideas. Potentially, I don't know. Just stretching it. But so what I was going to say is this. Do you believe in the notion that because they've committed to seeing a coach, that is at some level even the smallest doorway to getting them to be coachable? Or are there some cases that you just go, you know what, I don't know, you thought you needed to be here for some reason and I'm sorry, you're not coachable. I have to quote unquote fire the client.
Yeah, I have fired some clients. Yeah, I've done that. Now, here's the thing, and I take full responsibility for that. I take responsibility for not creating the requisite engagement, because that's not a simple and obvious thing to do. It's taken me years to become reasonably adept at creating the kind of engagement that is going to pretty much guarantee good results. So yes, there is a kind of part screening. I'm a lot more aware of the red flags and these sorts of things that might come about. Now, the idea that you're talking about here is just the very act of engaging a coach enough? Not necessarily is the answer to that, because people might engage a coach for 1,001 different reasons. You might get somebody, there's something I call the I could have been a contender syndrome, right? Which is where people actually take comfort from hanging out in trying or something like that, or even hanging out and not really trying. Do you see what I mean? So it's actually, that's different. I could have been a contender syndrome is where people don't really try too hard to change anything because they like to think if they had tried, they could actually have succeeded, but they didn't really try. But you also get this thing, which is like a safe haven where people hang out and they go, I'm trying. Right. And I've been hired by people on more than one occasion who just wanted to hang out and trying. And they didn't really want to fix a problem. They wanted to be seen by others and themselves as trying to sort out a problem.
Yes. Yes.
Right? So it's all part of a big pantomime. Now, I never used to be able to spot that very easily, but I've become better and better at sort of spotting it. Now, it doesn't mean that that client is necessarily not going to become a client, but it means that I have to address that and make sure that that elephant in the room is looked at with full consciousness and awareness by both me and the client ahead of time, right? It can't be left unspotlighted. It's a idea I call spotlighting the elephant. There's always an elephant in the room that you when you see it, you want to shine the light on it and say what it is. So I do think that some people are willing to spend a lot of money to hang out in the safety zone of trying. Or here's another one. Some people, if you look at the topic of personal mastery, some people go, oh, I really like that. I want you to coach me in personal mastery. Don't actually want to do anything in the world. Don't actually want to make anything happen.
Right.
I just want to work on myself. So that at some point I'll become the person who can make stuff happen.
Interesting.
Right? You know, and it's a place they can feel that they're making some good victories. They go, oh yeah, I'm really gaining a lot of insight into myself. Yeah, are you actually doing anything different in the world? Not yet, but you know, at some point I might. Now, it's a safe haven because there's no risk involved in just doing self-development in the mind only. There's no risk involved. So a person can trick themselves into feeling they're making real progress in their lives while actually they're not changing their results. They're not really changing their engagement with the world in any significant way, but they really do understand themselves more fully and more deeply, and they really are enjoying the coaching process. Right. So that's another phenomenon you can get come up in coaching.
Yeah. Yeah. Very interesting. Very interesting. You know, I wanted to bring it back for a second. I appreciate you going on that path.
We can go wherever.
Great. I appreciate it. You said you have a bunch of projects, you know, thousands of projects you want to do. And this intrigued me because I think it's going to get to our next really point about nonlinear creation and whatnot. You know, I'm curious about the notion of who you want to be, because you talk about this be, do, have model.
Yeah.
Do you have a sense of who you want to be when you have these thousands of projects? And if not, where does the interest in the projects come from? Do you envision the success piece that once they're completed? And I'm asking this, here's where I'm asking this from. The big frame is, what if I am someone that doesn't know what I want to do? Or I doubt that I know what I want to do and what I want to create in the world. That I'm not sure of what my big vision is for myself.
Yeah.
How do you move forward when there seems to be that much uncertainty?
Okay. That's a really good question. I'm glad that you actually brought it to that tangible frame. And I've had people ask me this in the past, like, how do I know what I really want? And my answer to that is, well, what if it's not about what you really want? What if the whole idea of really wanting something versus not really wanting something is just a mind-made distinction that doesn't really, you know, serve? So I'm kind of take this quite lightly often. And I say, well, who says you have to create what you really want? Just create stuff. Just start, you know, you can always quit something, you can change your mind. But if you're agonizing about, is this the right choice? Is this not the right, should I really be doing this? Well, you're never going to get anything done.
Yes.
You're never going to get anything created. So I got this analogy, which I'm sort of half loathed to speak out loud, but I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to take the risk.
Yeah,
I might be considered a pariah for doing this. Many years ago, when I was a younger man, I'm 48 now. This is back in my teens. Some people are going to find this shocking, what I'm about to say in the modern climate. Other people will go, yeah, that's human nature. Ever since I had my first girlfriend, I've never been single for more than about a week. Right? And some people will say this is absolutely shocking, but it's just true. It's just the way I used to do things. I didn't like being single. So, you know, I'd split up with somebody, I'd get dumped or something like that. And I would get myself another girlfriend really, really quickly, even if I wasn't that into her.
Whoa.
Right. And my mind was like, well, you know, this is what's here right now. So I'll kind of like roll with this. And then, you know, I might change course at some point in the future, which I inevitably did. Do you see what I mean? Now, some people say, well, that's terrible. You're using people. I don't know. Maybe it is. I'm not talking about the moral, you know, question around whether that was right or wrong behavior. It's just what I did, right? So I wasn't there holding out for the perfect relationship. I was just like, well, what's on the table right now? And I'd go for that. Right. Now, the reason I picked this as an analogy, because I guess maybe this is down to me and my personality. This is how I do life. I'm like, well, I want to be creating stuff. So the first thing is I choose to live as a creator. I used to say on my website, live as a creative force. Now, a creator is one who creates, like an author is one who writes books. If somebody says they're an author and they're not writing any books, well, they're not really an author.
Yeah.
Right. So like, I choose to live as a creator, a difference maker. It now says on my website, coaching creators and difference makers. So I'm always going to be creating something. So even if I didn't know what the ultimate best thing, the most amazing thing to create would be, it's like, well, what am I choosing to create right now? And that, by the way, is a question I ask myself with regularity. What am I choosing to create right now? I ask myself that several times a day. And that there's the scope of that could be big or small. I could go, what am I choosing to create right now? Okay, I'm choosing to create this blog post. What am I choosing to create right now? I'm choosing to create this shift with this person that I'm coaching. What am I choosing to create right now? I'm choosing to create this online program that's going to deliver this. What am I choosing to create right now? I'm choosing to create this book. I'm choosing to create this state of affairs. You know, some of the things I'm choosing to create right now are some new educational situations for my daughters. And their age has changed. Their educational requirements have changed. You know, I want to create some different life conditions for them in terms of education. So I think in terms of creation, but I don't think in terms of the correct creation, the right thing.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's really good because I have heard you talk about this before, and you're actually someone that turned me on to the work of Steve Chandler, who I know, and you can go up. I mean, I know Steve Hardison also coached him, and that question of what do you want to create is something that they both talk about, and you know, it's tricky because I sometimes sit here and go, okay, but does that question really isn't it really isn't I suppose, based on what you're saying, you know, this big end-all be-all, what art, what do you want to create? And what's tricky about that is that you normally think that coaching is about achieving that big vision, and it's marketed that way. Live the life of your dreams, find your soul purpose, your soul business. There's a lot of that talk in the coaching industry.
It's very neurosis inducing.
It brings up a ton of anxiety for me.
Yeah.
And this is a very different approach. And I suppose, yeah, is that when you're going into nonlinear creation dynamics, how does that then dovetail into what you're trying to bring into the world now?
Okay. So just to say something about that creation frame. For me, the important thing is the creation, like if you're looking at the sort of what you might call, I don't know, I've called them different things, creation dynamics, whatever. It's to see that creation happens at every level from small to large, right? So you can create a shift in your attitude in this moment. And that's creation.
Right.
Right? You can create, you are currently, you are creating your state of being in this moment. Right?
Yes.
So sometimes some of the things... If you have a relationship, so I was talking about my old roguish days where I would sort of, like a monkey, I wouldn't let go of one branch until I had hold of another firmly.
Right.
Now, my wife, who I'm with at the moment, I have been with for a couple of decades, more than a couple of decades, okay? We haven't been married for a couple of decades. We've been together for a long time. Now, one of the things that's important to me is our relationship and the quality of our relationship. So many people in a relationship, for example, they're passive. They're not creators in their relationship. They are reactors in their relationship.
Yes.
So they're like, oh, is this relationship making me happy? You know, oh, what's this person doing now? Do I like it? Do I dislike it? Oh, how can I change them so they stop doing that annoying thing? And this is a reactor's way of engaging with a relationship. And people will often, like, and I used to be like this. I would trade up one relationship for another because I was, this one's not right or whatever. I had a friend of mine, still a friend of mine. He said to me, he got married really young. And when he was about 19, he said, you know, the secret of a good relationship is being willing to work on it. And I dismissed him at the time. I was listening to agree or disagree. I said, no, that's rubbish. If it's right, you don't need to do any work on it. I had this strength, you know, this notion of perfection or romantic perfection or whatever. But you know, he was right. And I totally get what he's saying now, but it's not necessarily working on it. It's just going, well, what kind of relationship do I want? And recognizing, so for myself, I recognize myself as a co-creator of my relationships, my family relationships, my business relationships. So I want to be fully in my power to co-create a rewarding, fulfilling relationships, all of those relationships. And I recognize as well that it's a co-creation. So it's not about controlling the other person or making them fit my needs. It's about us co-creating together a relationship that would be rewarding and fulfilling in both directions. So in my kind of personal family relationships, that's an explicit frame. Everyone's a co-creator. When I coach, there's an explicit co-creation frame. Whatever we're creating, me and the client, we're co-creating together. So the shifts in being for the client, they're co-creations. So creation can happen at every level. It's not just a bringing a thing into the world that wasn't there before, like a book or a business or something like that. Yes, that's creation too. But those creations come from sort of micro-creations, you know, micro-creations, and there's an emergent level of creations that come from that, and then a level that come from that. So when I talk about, you know, who do you need to be to create that result, the who you need to be is a creation. So it's like you're creating your being first to be the kind of person that can create those kind of results that you want to have out there in the world. The things, the material results. So if you look at the be do have model, we're creating at every level, being, doing, and having. So the have, that's our intention. That's the thing we want to see come into the world. Well, we could go, yeah, that's a creation. I need to create that thing into the world. But if we go, well, who is the person who creates that? And am I being that person already, or am I not? And if I'm not being that person, then I want to also look at creating myself to be the person that does create that. And I want to be aware of how I'm creating myself as the person who doesn't create that as well.
Hmm.
So if I'm laying low or hanging back, I want to go, how am I creating that? If I'm fearful, how am I creating the fear? How am I creating my relationship to the fear? So creation happens at multiple levels. Now, if I'm asking questions, how am I creating fear? Obviously, I want to be able to go into my own psyche and go, you know, what's the story that I'm buying into that's creating fear?
Yeah.
You know, or I wrote on a video, I think the last video I put out, I just put like a thing saying, what's the single biggest thing that's holding you back from creating what you want in your life right now? First answer somebody put was lack of self-belief, right? And I thought, excellent. Kudos to that person for not pointing out to their circumstances and for going, for recognizing that it was within them. But that idea, lack of self-belief, what does that mean? It's a common phrase we hear in our culture. But what I think it means is, I don't believe I can achieve the things. I don't believe that I've got what it takes to deliver that. That's what it usually means. Right. So yeah. The question then for me is, if I catch myself thinking, well, I don't think I've got what it takes, or I don't think that's going to be possible, I'm going to go, hey, hang on a second, because I know straight away that that's an idea, not a fact. So I want to look and go, so how are these ideas creating my state of being? What are they creating me? And I want to be able to recreate from the inside out my state of being so that I can be that person that has the things I want to have happening. So creation is a multi-level thing. And living in your power as a creator rather than a reactor, i.e., oh, these are the circumstances, I'm just going to mindlessly react to them. Or here's some belief that I've unquestioned, I'm just going to mindlessly react to it.
Yeah.
No. So that's back to the self-mastery thing again. So creation, self-mastery, creation frame, they're intimately connected for me.
Part one. What'd you think? I want to know what you think. You want to hear part two? Let me know. Go to ratethispodcast.com/openloops. Subscribe to the show, rate the show, leave a review. I want to hear what you think. This was one of my favorites. Is it one of yours too? There was some real meat there. And there was some real impossible burger plant-based meat there. I loved it. Thank you, James Tripp. Thank you, Rodney McGilvery, for the theme music. You're not going to want to miss part two, the inner workings of creation and wealth. Talk soon.